come.
While calling Khan's long march a flop show, the government says that it will complete its constitutional term and the electoral process will be held at its scheduled time. Imran Khan supporters say the recent massive mass rallies indicate Imran Khan's increasing popularity in his political domain. However, it is highly believed that his party will face tough political competition if the scheduled general elections are held, according to the government's plan. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders, and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to a Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is not a lecture, but a picket line. Lecturers, librarians, and researchers are out here as part of a massive strike across the country. 150 universities are involved in 3 days of industrial action, affecting up to 2.5 million students. Action these students support.
If they're not paid properly, they can't teach properly, and therefore we can't learn properly, and then we're not getting what we're paying for in the first place.
Teaching conditions are learning conditions, and as long as our teachers aren't paid well, they can't teach well.
We think it's really important that teachers get a fair pay, and it's important for our learning conditions as well, so we stand in solidarity with our teachers.
The list of grievances is long. Trade unions say staff pay and pensions have declined by 25 and 35% respectively since 2009, in real terms, while workloads have increased. Lecturers earn an average of $55,000 a year. Academics are increasingly being offered short-term contracts, meaning many have to reapply for their jobs every few months.
People who are having to work more than one job in order to stay alive because the jobs that they get are casualized, their contracts are not secured, and the salaries they get for each job they do isn't sufficient to keep them alive. We've had stories up and down the country of people who, for example, have to live in a tent because they can't afford to pay the rent on a lecturer's salary because they're casualized.
You can't plan where you're going to live, you can't plan having a family, you never know exactly how long you're going to be employed, so you can't plan anything.
The average undergraduate degree costs around $35,000 in tuition fees. That's excluding books, travel, and accommodation. Students from outside the UK pay double or more.
If you're a teacher, one of your tasks is to steer your pupils into a job, to tell them that at the end of the day, education pays off, that it has societal value. But the reality is that some of the brightest minds in Britain are struggling to make a living.
Compare that with the average vice chancellor's pay, which is 6.5 times greater than the average staff member's. This is the latest in a wave of escalating industrial action taking place across the UK. Workers in several other sectors, such as the postal service, transportation, and health, also walking out for similar reasons. Negotiations between university staff and management are ongoing. Meanwhile, frustration among academics is growing that universities are putting profit before people. Saeed Purizap, London.
A recent Afghanistan welfare monitoring survey by the World Bank is sounding the alarm bell about the devastating living conditions of Afghan people. People are struggling to put food on the table while lacking access to many other simple necessities. Almost half the population has reported a constant decrease in monthly earnings.
We are facing many difficulties, especially in recent weeks. We slid into a bad recession. I work from dawn to dark, selling potatoes and onions. But so far, I haven't even made a penny to buy some loaves of bread for my 6 children. Our house is cold and I have not bought fuel. I am concerned about the health of my children.
The survey has also found a rise in unemployment rates across the country. More and more Afghans are finding it difficult to land a job. The situation is only expected to get worse during the coming winter months. World Bank officials have called on Taliban rulers to take action on improving the living conditions of Afghan people. The Taliban says it does have plans, but needs access to the Afghan assets frozen by Washington in order to make them work.
With regards to addressing people's livelihoods and poverty, I confess there have been problems, and the major reason for the economic crisis and deprivation of Afghans is that their assets are crucially frozen. Furthermore, Afghanistan is practically sanctioned. Those who were defeated in Afghanistan use sanctions as tools for advancing their foreign diplomacy, but we are trying to neutralize the effects of sanctions and move Afghanistan to gradually become stable and self-sufficient.
The U.S. withdrew its forces from Afghanistan in 2021, but that has not stopped American politicians from asserting pressure on Afghan people. The war-torn country has not yet got the chance to repair the damage caused by more than 2 decades of Western aggression. As the winter comes closer, more and more Afghans are struggling. People here believe urgent support from the international community can be a lifeline for millions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The EU is currently paying more for gas than any other region in the world. The European Commission had proposed to cap natural gas prices at €275 per megawatt hour. The idea was totally rubbished by the bloc's energy ministers at a meeting on Thursday.
A ceiling between 150 and 200 euro is a realistic ceiling, and this could help us reduce gas prices and therefore reduce electricity prices.
But any sort of a cap could result in gas suppliers moving their tankers to other parts of the world where there is no cap, like Asia.
If we really see that this mechanism is designed in the way that that we will lose LNG cargoes to other international markets, then we can suspend it.
As things stand in the EU, there is no guarantee of a manageable gas price or even a gas supply for 2023.
If we cannot keep our economy running, we will not be able to support Ukraine, and we must do everything to avoid such scenario.
Those representing small to medium-sized businesses are looking for EU support amid high inflation and growing interest rates.
If we not want to fight unemployment and youth unemployment, we need to take care about the growth and competitiveness of European SMEs.
A debate in the European Parliament this week on promoting stability in the Middle East heard that the initiative would help ensure energy security for the EU. However, one lawmaker raised the West's previous actions in the region.
Leaving broken countries, hobbled economies, violence, trauma and permanent conflict. And at the end of that, we stroke our chins, pretend we've nothing to do about it and ask how we We are going to promote stability in the region. You have got to be joking.
EU energy ministers will meet again on the 13th of December to try and reach agreement on the vital question of 2023 gas supplies. Analysts say this crisis best illustrates how sanctions against Russia have backfired. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. The recent decision by Italy to close its ports to the Ocean Viking vessel carrying 234 refugees has been slated in the European Parliament. The vessel, operated by a charity, was eventually allowed to dock in France.
How cynical is it that NGOs filling this gap and saving lives are criminalised, whereas the states violating their obligation enjoy impunity?
Asylum applications have increased by 60% in the EU during the past 12 months. That figure is separate from those arriving from Ukraine. In fact, the 27 EU nations are providing maximum support to Ukrainians, while those from other countries are often forced to sleep on the streets.
How dare so many of you define yourself as Christians and repeat that you are defending Christian values when your ideas and your actions are proof of the opposite?
In the Mediterranean alone, 2,000 refugees have drowned so far this year, according to the International Organization for Migration. The message seems to be, if you're not one of the 4 million Ukrainians who have arrived in the EU in recent months, you're not welcome. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. Apparently, the far right is flourishing in the EU due to the bloc's neglect of refugees.
How did Lega get big? How did the AfD get big? How did Marine Le Pen get big? It's all by capitalizing on the fears of migration.
The ascent of the extreme right in the EU is certainly bad news for asylum seekers, according to analysts.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
EU Home Affairs ministers will hold an emergency meeting on the refugee crisis this Friday. There's a great deal of scepticism that anything will be achieved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Deal or no deal? While the EU is still reluctant to lay its negotiating cards on the table, at a press conference in the capital, Tehran, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stressed that Iran's negotiating team is ready for the next round of talks and is waiting for the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, to set a date for ministerial-level negotiations.
We have made our stance clear, and in the previous negotiations, we communicated our views regarding the remaining issues. Last week, we announced that we are ready for the next round of talks, and now Mr. Borrell is following up and trying to set a date. Obviously, talk will continue if we make sure that our logical demands are met.
In the words of Hossein Amir Abdollahian, resolving the remaining issues with the IAEA, receiving guarantees on the economic benefits of the deal for Iran, and removing unilateral sanctions are the three key issues that need to be worked out.
The JCPOA revival talks are high on the agenda, and we are adamantly following up on the issue. Of course, this will happen when we make sure that our reasonable demands in line with our national interests are met.
According to the top diplomat, Iran and the U.S. continue to exchange messages. However, American officials take what Amir Abdollahian calls a hypocritical stance while talking to mainstream media by making comments that contradict the messages that they send to Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has always deviated from its technical path and taken a political stance. European and American negotiators had promised that this would not happen again, but they broke their promise yet another time.
These comments come after a recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA Board of Governors prompted the Islamic Republic to announce that it will begin 60% uranium enrichment in its Fordo nuclear facility. Over the past couple of years, Iran has demonstrated in practice that it is committed to the JCPOA, or the nuclear deal. It has always been the other side that has neglected the agreement. Now, Iran says for these negotiations to reach a final conclusion, it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A new report shows that social media giants, including Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube, have failed to curb the spread of right-wing extremism and disinformation on their platforms regarding the U.S. midterm elections. Meanwhile, a new poll shows that over 2 in 5 Americans say they are concerned about being subject to intimidation or violence when voting in the midterms. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the details, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube are failing to curb the spread of right-wing extremism and disinformation on their platforms and must immediately implement safeguards with the pivotal U.S. midterm elections less than 2 weeks away, a watchdog has warned recently. In empty promises, inside Big Tech's weak effort to fight hate and lies in 2022, Free Press analyzed the policies of the 4 social media giants to measure how prepared each one is to combat Trump-backed efforts to sow doubts about upcoming electoral outcomes. According to Free Press, the problem is just as dire in advance of the 2022 U.S. midterms as it was during the nation's 2020 elections. In particular, the report found that the major social media networks have failed to clearly update their election integrity systems in time for the elections, created a labyrinth of company commitments, announcements, and policies that make it difficult to assess what they are really doing, if anything, to protect users, and failed to close what they call newsworthiness or public interest exceptions that give prominent users and politicians a get-out-of-jail-free card and allow them to post lies without consequences from the platforms. Free Press warned that these failures are likely to be felt not only at polling stations on November 8, but also on the streets. The unchecked spread of online lies about the 2020 election fueled real-world violence on January 6, said Nora Benavides, report author and senior counsel and director of digital justice and civil rights at Free Press, adding, "And although most people in the United States now believe that big tech should do more to curb the online spread of disinformation and incitements to violence, social media companies keep failing to protect users. As the report notes, Change the Terms, a coalition of more than 60 civil and consumer rights organizations, developed a set of 15 priority reforms for social media companies to implement ahead of the midterm elections that would fight algorithmic applications of hate and lies, protect users across all languages, and increase company transparency. Our coalition, of which Free Press is a founding member, then met with Meta, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube throughout the summer 2022, calling on each company to implement these 15 priority reforms as soon as possible and to share more data about their enforcement practices around election integrity. Although tech companies had promised to fight disinformation and hate on their platforms this fall, there is a notable gap between what the companies say they want to do and what they actually do in practice. In sum, platforms do not have sufficient policies, practices, AI, or human capital in place to materially mitigate harm ahead of and during the November midterms. Benen Davies said, even in writing, platforms like Meta, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube can't commit to the most basic online protections to limit the spread of the disinformation and hate. And in practice, our research shows ongoing gaps in companies' enforcement of their own meager safety policies. She added, "These are systematic failures across all of the major social media companies that show how little the companies care about safeguarding elections and fighting extremism and lies on their platforms." After Twitter's new mega billionaire owner, Elon Musk, fired several of the platform's key leaders immediately upon taking over, Benavides warned that content moderation on the site is poised to become even worse. Free Press urged Facebook parent company Meta, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube to take the following steps to stem the spread of bigotry and lies on their platforms, including stop amplifying hate and disinformation content and implement algorithms without discrimination, protect people equally around the world and across languages through increased resourcing for civic integrity teams year-round, and boost transparency about company business models and moderation and enforcement practices, ensuring access to data for external researchers and journalists. We're less than 2 weeks from the U.S. midterms, Benavides tweeted, adding, over 30 other national elections have occurred around the world this year, featuring conspiracy theories and lies fanned by online rhetoric that social media companies allow to flourish. What will it take for the culture of big tech to change? What will it take for civil and human rights to become a real priority with evidence to show for it? Meanwhile, the website of Truth Out wrote, over 2 in 5 Americans polled over the past week say they are concerned about being subject to intimidation or violence when voting in the midterms. New polling finds in an alarming show of the state of democracy in the U.S. According to a poll from Reuters Ipsos of over 4,400 U.S. adults, about 43% of Americans say they are worried about facing threats at polling locations. Democrats are more likely to be concerned about violence at about 51% versus Republicans 38%, likely fueled at least in part by the far-right's attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021, Americans are also concerned that groups will carry out violence after the election if they are unsatisfied with the outcome. The poll found, with over 2 in 3 Americans saying as such, the poll comes as there have been reports of armed far-right vigilantes intimidating voters in Arizona. Though there have not yet been reports of violence, the vigilantes have apparently been taking pictures of people using ballot drop boxes and threatening to post their information online. The vigilantes appear to have been galvanized by debunked right-wing claims that so-called ballot mules are stuffing boxes with ballots for Democrats. While there is zero evidence of widespread voter fraud or anything resembling ballot stuffing, the belief appears to have become so entrenched that vigilantes are taking it upon themselves to supposedly guard ballot boxes. Despite having no basis in reality, voter fraud has become a concern among the public as well. The Reuters Ipsos poll found that nearly half of Americans think that voter fraud is a widespread problem, while only 40% disagree. Republicans are more likely to believe in this lie popularized by Donald Trump, with 2/3 of Republicans saying they believe that widespread voter fraud is an issue, and about 1/3 of Democrats saying as such. There have been other threats to voters from the right. In Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis' fascist election police arrested 20 people earlier this month, claiming that they knowingly violated election guidelines. But like many others who have been prosecuted for election-related offenses, those arrested were simply unaware of their voter eligibility status. In this case, some of the voters arrested were supposedly previously told that they were eligible to vote, but then they were arrested for illegally registering. At least 13 of the people who were arrested were black. The fact that concerns of violence in relation to casting a vote are so widespread and that there are already reports of intimidation is an alarming show of the erosion of democracy in the U.S. The far right has been ramping up voter suppression efforts in recent years. Between the Republican Party's gerrymandering, plans to mass challenge election results and infiltrate Democratic majority polling places or bills to flat out allow Republican officials to overturn election results, experts say the GOP is setting the stage to rig elections so that they never lose or effectively lose despite voters' will again.
This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A meeting to have convened with no legal basis, based on inaccurate conclusions and findings. It was also based on an initiative put forward by Germany and Iceland. The UN Rights Council convened, then described the Iran riots as a government crackdown on deadly protests, and now it has voted to appoint a probe into what they have termed Iran's deadly crackdown on protests. Well, Iran has rejected the whole thing outright and has said that it will not cooperate with the agency. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the UN body lacks the grounds for conducting the so-called investigation and how it has opened itself to lose even more legitimacy on the international stage. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Firsal Najim, a manager at the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joins us from Toronto. Also joining us is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, who joins us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Elijah Magnier, I'll first start with you. I'm holding in my hands what is the criteria for communication to be accepted for examination at the UNHRC. And out of the seven statements that they have here for what needs to be qualified in order to actually have a criteria to open up a UN rights probe, six out of the seven of that does not meet the criteria that was put forward by Germany and Iceland. For example, number one, it is not manifestly politically motivated, and its object is consistent with the Charter of the UN. It gives a factual description, that's number two, of the alleged violations, including the rights which are alleged to be violated. So there's seven of them. Six of them don't meet that criteria. So that puts the legality of the motion put forward by Germany and Iceland into doubt.
Thank you for having me. It doesn't matter, really. It's not important what the points contained, because it is a decision of the West to put pressure on Iran and find different excuses to do so. Now, we've seen how the pressure on Iran and the nuclear deal didn't work. The riots didn't work to change the regime in Iran. And now they try to put all the different Western institutions in motion to try to put more pressure on Iran from different angle to push Iran to the negotiation table or to keep Iran away from supporting Russia in Ukraine and make sure that Iran is not interfering in the plan of the West to cripple Russia, and also to say to Iran, well, we need to conclude the deal, not to the Iranian terms, but to the Western terms. Therefore, we can see different aspects of the West manifested through the United Nations, through the IAEA, through all kind of tools that the West is always using and falling back to, only to weaken the position of Iran and to bring Iran back to the line with the United States and its allies, or at least to bring it weak to the negotiation table.
But first, on the team, when you take a look at the way that the events unfolded from the perspective of the West in particular, you're looking at how they went out, they did a smear campaign on Iran. They did not really divulge the public opinion and inform the public opinion or the public about what is actually happening inside of Iran. They left out so many things. But the smear campaign reached a maximum point, not only through the media, but also through different types of these so-called demonstrations that took place or protests, whether it was in Germany or Sweden or the States. And then here you are. You have a UN convening, the UNHRC convening, and then wanting to do a probe, obviously putting a resolution and slamming Iran for what it calls the government crackdown on these protests. So they went out and they pretty much found Iran guilty by building up to it.
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, this body is dominated by certain powers, and they have an agenda, and they're pushing their agenda forward. And, you know, the good thing is that Iran is resisting, and Iran is, you know, exposing this body and showing that it's not truly working for human rights. And if it really did work for human rights, then it would punish the German regime that, you know, supplied chemical weapons to Saddam and killed thousands of Iranians, and as well, how many of them have been, you know, still till this day suffering from the consequences of that illegal measure that was done by the Saddam regime at that time. So how come they didn't hold accountable the German regime for these crimes that they're doing? And how about they didn't hold the German regime accountable for supplying arms to Saudi Arabia that's killing the Yemeni people day and night and blockading the people of Yemen? So this is a very biased approach and plan, and it's going to fail hopefully, because they've always failed with Iran, with the Islamic Republic of Iran and its wise leadership. It's been very clear that they cannot win anything in this battle. Like, they've always lost, and they've always tried to do something to put pressure and to cause some kind of division inside and weaknesses, and they've always continued to flee, but they continue to try new methods and different tactics and strategies. And you know, it's unfortunate they don't really work for human rights, because if they did, they could really quickly stop a lot of wars happening in different countries, and can stop international law breaches, especially by the Israeli regime, for instance, that continues to breach the international law. How come they have never adopted a resolution for an unbiased investigation to the crimes such as killing Shireen Abu Akleh or shooting a Canadian doctor, Tariq Labouni? At that time, they were actually having some kind of resolution. They were trying to adopt it, and it failed because there was bullying going on inside the United Nations, and including Canadian UN ambassador at that time. He also worked to have that not successful. He didn't want an international independent investigation done on a Canadian doctor that was shot. He thought it was biased, and that's what he said to the Zionists in Canada to try to satisfy them. So the human rights is all selective, and they're biased, and they're working for a certain agenda, and what fits their agenda, they do. And this is why they're working right now on the Iran file, and especially at the time where there's the World Cup and people are busy, they're trying to put more pressure and more plans against Iran. And Sayyid Khamenei has spoken yesterday about that in the Besiege weekly meeting. He said that we got to be careful, because right now they're planning different things while people are busy watching the World Cup.
Indeed. Well, when you take a look at what's happened and how things have progressed from what first started out as peaceful protests, of which it was then robbed by these rioters, of which it led to the destruction of property and basically violence to be encouraged by different media outlets, even politicians, hasn't the landscape changed? Elijah Magnier, from one that now the UN is presenting it as a human rights issue, where Iran is looking at it through a different lens, such as the time where just days ago Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian came out and said, first accusing Israel and Western intel services of plotting to start a civil war in the Islamic Republic, where he said various security services, Israel and some Western politicians have made plans for this. And then he said, of course, Iran is not Libya or Sudan. There's not a day that goes by that we don't see arms trying to force its way through that doesn't get confiscated or that's discovered. Or you have different terrorist groups that are operating, such as the MKO cult or Kamala or PJAC. Of course, we had that terrorist incident that happened in Isfahan, of which we had 15 people who were killed, and it was Daesh related. So this is now a matter of people being killed in that arena, in that environment. It's not about human rights now. There's an assault that's happening on Iran. Shouldn't it be looked that way and for countries to try to prevent that from happening?
Well, yesterday we had a big protest in the street of Brussels, and the police was quite violent with the population. We saw also in other European states, in Germany, in France, how the police behaved. We've seen that in the US. All that doesn't matter really, because mainstream media is focused particularly on everything that is happening in Iran. So when we see a man throwing Molotov on civilian houses, that is not reported in Iran. However, we've seen any fake movement and any fake pictures that show something that happened in Afghanistan or in Iraq or in Yemen and reported as it is in Iran. Then we see even the Prime Minister of Canada retweeting that Iran is going to kill 15,000 protesters that are in jail. So it has reached a laughable level where the credibility of the West is not only in jeopardy, but is completely lost. But it doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, there is an agenda that they pushed against Iran since 1979 to cripple the Iranian population and to talk about the Western human rights. That is the real title of it. It's a double standard, because as the Americans say to their foreign minister who takes the job, and here I'm quoting Rex Tillerson, we use human rights against our enemy like Iran, Cuba, Russia, and China, and Korea, and we don't use it against our friend. So it is obviously a tool, and I'm not inventing anything. I'm just repeating the word of the American themselves within the same administration against the enemy of the U.S. or against those who are refusing to submit to the U.S. policy and are challenging the U.S. hegemony in the Middle East, West Asia, and other part of the world, including Latin America. So we have seen this behavior, harsh sanction against Venezuela, Cuba, now Russia, Iran since 1979. All that falls into the same box and is the same playbook, is we have to cripple any regime, any state that stand against us. Now, the Americans have quite a strong influence over the Europeans, so they push the German to do their dirty laundry. They push other countries, depending on each time what is the cause, to show to the world there is a diversity of countries who are saying exactly the same thing, and it is not the U.S. behind it, which is not true, because everything is manipulated by the U.S. One of the main advisors of a European prime minister told me we receive a piece of paper where it is written, this is what you need to do, and then we do it according to what the Americans want without really negotiating if that falls into our interest or not. Sure. So that is the practice here in Europe.
Well, what's happening is that the way that the population in general is suffering for El Salam Najim is due to the sanctions that have been exercised against Iran now for decades. And in particular, we're looking at how that has been ramped up with this so-called maximum pressure campaign, of which it got worse when the former U.S. president tore up that JCPOA agreement. I mean, at this point, if we were just to look at the area of pharmaceuticals and medicine, the prices have skyrocketed in this country by so many times. And if this was controlled, if this was even, it's supposed to be excluded from the sanctions, but it's not. People are not able to access, or the country is not able to access, life-saving medicine in a variety of different areas that it's needed. So then it becomes a human rights issue, but the source emanates from the West that has exercised these sanctions, in particular the U.S.
Yes, unfortunately, you know, this is their unhumanitarian style. that they don't care about the humans that are suffering inside Iran. But as long as their agenda and their strategy is working, this is what counts for them, and this is what they feel they're doing right. So they want to hurt the Iranian nation so they can somehow be angry with the government, and then hopefully, you know, in the coming years or days, that those people will rise up against the government when they, you know, when there's an issue or there's a problem, and they can somehow, you know, instigate, somehow infiltrate and do what they're doing. And this is exactly what they're doing right now in Iran. They found the opportunity because there is a good amount of people in Iran that are suffering because of the unlawful sanctions against the Iranian people and the Iranian government. And this also, you know, brought their sentiments up and their energy up, and they went out and protested, and then all the social media backing, all this mainstream media backing, all these, you know, so-called human rights organizations in the West started pushing so heavily, and people started, you know, being deceived. You know, some people that are in the streets, not everybody. Obviously, there's a good a portion of people in Iran that have a lot of wisdom, and they trust their leadership, and they trust the agenda of the government of Iran. But, you know, these type of developments only show you and expose the West, you know, that they don't care about human rights, that they do not care about the actual Iranian nation. They do not care about, you know, sovereignty. They do not care about liberty. They do not care about justice. They don't care about human rights. They care about their interests, and that is to control the region and to support the Israeli regime that is the base that supports their control of the region. As long as they have that base there, they can, you know, they can get information, they can launch wars, they can have allies that are puppets that can help them also with giving them good information and using their land as a base to control the region. And Iran has been in the forefront to fight all this imperialist powers, control of the region, and to support the Palestinian oppressed people to liberate their land from these usurpers, from these war criminals and mercenaries.
Looking at the way that the news is covered by some of these media outlets, Elijah Magnier, one of the agencies that they mention is an activist news agency called HRANA, of which it is cited, based on the most recent report, that a few hundred protesters had been killed, and it mentioned 63 minors to have been killed. It also said that 60 members of the security forces had been killed. Now, none of these numbers can be verified, because those numbers that they are getting is not based on actual records that they have access to, or based on any type of government insight into this and then verification. But what is interesting, and the reason why I'm mentioning this, is that when they talk about, for example, the number that's been detained, they fail to mention how many hundreds, in some cases, are then released after a few days, because we're dealing with protests and protesters or rioters in many other cases that get arrested. So they don't mention the ones that get released. At the same time, the number of security forces that have been killed is not something that is even given any type of elaboration on, except for it to be mentioned. They don't talk about the way that these security forces, not only how they're defending the country, but how they're being killed. So they're basing it on a very biased source. This particular source has been mentioned a number of times. Isn't that then presenting a false picture?
It is, and the mainstream media is going to be very harsh on Iran because they have learned the lesson from Syria. I've covered the war in Syria for over 10 years. Every single day we dealt with this misinformation and manipulation, the pictures. And the journalists who are supposed to be professional, they would contact anyone in the street with a mobile phone and then just take anything that this person would say as a face value and become the story of the day. So we have seen how bombs were lie down on a bed without being exploded and saying that these are chemical bombs. We've seen people how they are thrown at with water because they washing them from chemical attacks. So all these kind of manipulation that I've seen in other wars and now in Ukraine is also applied in Iran heavily. And all that has one objective, is just to demonize Iran and show how the Iranian regime is so harsh on the population, how there is a violation of human rights, and how we need to free the population of Iran. This is exactly what President Biden said, and then his national security advisor needed to apologize in secrecy to Iran via Qatar and saying, well, he didn't really mean that. So the objective, we hear it from the American, they want either to change the regime in Iran or to submit it. So by manipulating pictures and not showing how people are walking in the street, and these are the criminals in Iran who are stabbing a police officer who are unarmed, and they are not allowed to shoot at the protesters, but they are killed in the street because they don't have any means to defend themselves. Well, we don't see this in mainstream media because we're not supposed to feel in, and support the Iranian government. We're supposed to be against it and against anything that Iran is doing by just watching a few minutes of any video posted on social media, and then this becomes the ultimate truth. This is a media manipulation that Iran is suffering from and will suffer even more because their Iranian enemies are becoming better and better. They're improving their capability. They're using not only fake news, but fake images. They can put any picture, any voice on the person and say, well, this is the proof that this person said that or did this or did that. So we're coming into a very sophisticated media and information war that every country needs to be very well equipped to stand against it, to face it, and to fight against it.
Last question, since we've ran out of time. Iran's government spokesperson, Kanani, has said, Feroz al-Najim, that Iran has proof that Western nations were involved in these riots that have swept many parts of the country, where he said, quote, we have specific information proving the U.S. Western countries and some of the American allies to have had a role in these riots. He's going to obviously have at a later date make a presentation on that, or the intelligence ministries, of which they have come out and said that before also and provided some evidence of that. Is that what Iran should do, is present the evidence that it has and then stop there, or should Iran do more? Less than a minute, if you can, please.
Yes, I mean, Iran has to obviously produce the evidence in front of the world, in front of the media, in front of the United Nations, and expose these regimes and expose these media outlets as well. And, you know, go further to complain also at the United Nations and to punish and penalize, you know, this manipulation and this defamation project against Iran. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, the Basij did a very good job, those volunteers inside of Iran. And this is the Basij week, as Sayyid Khamenei said, that they're very important, you know, force inside Iran that, you know, keeps Iran safeguarded and supports the Islamic Republic of Iran. And keeps also the moral codes up to date and standards based on the Islamic laws, and that the West need to respect other people's laws, and they need to understand that not everybody has to follow their laws and their morals, you know, their standards of morals. And they need, they're learning that a little bit now in Qatar, and hopefully they'll start to learn more about that, the Islamic Republic of Iran's laws.
Thank you very much for that, Feroz al-Najim. Manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Elijah Magnier, thank you for your contribution, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye. Until the next Spotlight.